Hey everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Seriously Risky Business podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. Seriously Risky Business is, of course, the podcast that we do, which is more of interest to the government policy types who listen to our content. And it is made possible thanks to support from the Hewlett Foundation's Cyber Initiative and our founding corporate sponsor, Proofpoint. Now, of course, there would be no Seriously Risky Business podcast without our Seriously Risky Business editor and writer, Tom Uren. Tom, thank you very much for joining me.
Hey, Pat.
So we've got a few things, as usual, to get through this week. We're just about to publish the newsletter, and that's what we do in these recordings is we sort of talk through the topics you've covered in the newsletter. Last week, we looked at some changes the United States made to its Intelligence Authorization Act concerning commercial spyware. But it looks like, and you know, we were saying that this is an issue that now has some politics attached to it, but it looks like there's going to be more coming from the looks of things, based on comments from the House Intelligence Committee Chair, Adam Schiff.
Yeah, that's right. So Schiff indicated that he was really concerned about the way that spyware is getting more easily available and more sophisticated. So I break down those concerns into that spyware can be used to target governments themselves, and Schiff obviously cares about the US government. But that it can also be used to perpetrate human rights abuses by, you know, authoritarian governments. We've seen heaps of examples of that over time. So what can we do about those two separate problems? And the good news is that the kind of mitigations you try and impose from a policy point of view are basically the same for both of them. So I looked at some reports, a UN special rapporteur, which is basically a special investigator, independent, and they've looked at surveillance and spyware over time. And they've basically come up with this kind of all-encompassing, what I call the maximalist position, which is that at each opportunity, you do what you can to try and tamp down on the industry. So that would involve laws in all countries, ideally, that would specify what you can and can't do with surveillance and spyware, you know, appropriate oversight. It would also involve export control. So who can you export it to? What would stop you? Human rights assessments of those export controls and increased transparency. So who are the companies that make it? Where's it going to? What are they doing with it? So those seem like a comprehensive package, right? The problem is it seems to me that any one of those things is a long-term project. There's no quick wins there. Getting governments, for example, to design their own legislation to basically restrict themselves, I think is a pretty hard ask. And I don't think it'll work anytime soon for the governments that we really care about. In those kinds of countries that use spyware to persecute like dissidents or human rights activists, they're doing that because they care about staying in power. Yeah. And so what's the incentive to restrict their own capabilities there? There's none. And if they do impose legislation, it'll only be because they think they need to do it to get access to spyware.
Yeah.
Now, at the same time, laws do matter, right? There's a reason governments have laws. And so I think it's a worthy goal. It's just not one that's going to work in the short term because you really need the surrounding apparatus of government to work well.
It's interesting because you are a cynic, right? You're cynical about the ability of these sort of long-term initiatives to do things like marry export controls to human rights assessments and things like that. And the export controls on stuff like this are inherently difficult because, as you point out, you can use that same tool to surveil a criminal syndicate that's killing people, but you can also use the same tool to misuse, you know, you can misuse it for political purposes, right? And the same country that's using it to do the good things can use it to do the bad things, right? So that's the issue with the export control stuff. So ultimately, it might be the sanctions power that's been granted to the White House under the Intelligence Authorization Act that will be the useful thing here. And that's where you go in your piece. And there's a part of the newsletter that I really like, which is where, you know, you point out that these sanctions are quite flexible. You don't need rigid rules for when they're applied because basically you'll know bad behavior when you see it.
Yeah, I spoke to Bobby Chesney, the dean at the University of Texas Law School, And he said that he thought sanctions were kind of underrated. He made the point that there's just some groups that you'll never influence, some groups that are amenable, like some spyware providers who kind of want to do this, the right thing, or maybe perhaps more accurately, don't want to overstep the law too far. And those are the kind of groups that you're actually trying to influence. I guess the technical aspect of spyware, it's very, very hard to define exactly what is acceptable and what is not. I mean, we had a discussion about when is a secessionist a lawful target. And so there's Catalan independence movement. Is that a lawful target? Well, perhaps if it's associated with violent acts, like actual terrorist acts. But I pointed out the Scottish independence movement, probably not a legitimate target. But using sanctions, you're able to assess what's being done when you learn about it and decide, is that okay or is that not okay? And then make a decision that doesn't rely on having all the facts beforehand, like a human rights assessment would.
Well, the good thing about sanctions is they actually allow judgment to enter the decision, right? And they don't have to be made against set criteria. So that's actually terrifying to some people, but obviously quite an advantage for others. I guess another thing here that I found interesting, and you know, Bobby makes this point, right? That once you apply sanctions, Treasury sanctions to one of these organizations, you destroy them and here's his quote, they're destroyed as objects of investment and their business model is ruined. So it's a pretty big stick that I think people will be scared of. I have a feeling, though, that before any of this stuff is reined in, we're going to need to see some more sanctions. We've already seen some applied against NSO, and they've had a pretty devastating effect. But I do get the sense that if the United States does this to a couple more companies, that's when we're going to start to see behavior improve. You know, the beatings will continue until behavior improves.
Yeah, exactly. So I think those proposals in the Intelligence Authorization Act are good. I think there's different types of sanctions, so potentially you could consider making the most stringent ones available for these kind of actors. I guess at this point you just run with the ones you have and see how that works out. If you need more powers, go try and get them, I guess.
Yeah. But I guess, you know, the main takeaway here is that there's going to be some wonderful kumbaya-style laws coming down the pipe, but probably the sanctions are what's going to get her done.
Definitely in the short term.
Yeah. Now, you've also taken a look at ransomware, and this is a really interesting piece of analysis, Tom, because what you've done is you've looked at some reporting that says ransomware crews are experiencing some difficulties, and then some other reporting that says they're not, and you've looked at why they differ. And this is often the problem, isn't it, with trying to determine what's happening with ransomware, is it's very difficult to get reliable metrics on things like payment volumes, even infection volumes, and there's so many different ways to measure it. But it does seem like ransomware as a service operators are having a little bit more of a difficult time because the ransomware as a service business model is just a little bit too vulnerable to interference. And, you know, maybe some of the operators are running into some trouble there.
Yeah. So Coveware, which is a ransomware incident response firm, produces a quarterly report where they look at the data they get from the incidents they handle. And they have this section in this quarter's report that deals with ransomware as a service. And they point out that things that were powerful because they were centralized and could scale actually also bring increased risk. So the example is you share branding, and that's great when you cause an incident because everyone knows who you are and you
but
know,
it's also bad when you cause an incident because everybody knows who you are.
Exactly. And so when you cause an incident that sort of sticks its head above the parapet and becomes a target, a geopolitical target, a target of intense interest, then everyone who shares the brand suffers. And that risk reward has shifted in the last 6 months, I suppose, ever since Colonial Pipeline. So they think that's true for the shared infrastructure, shared data storage, branding, and also negotiations. So all of those elements that were good now come with increased risk. And one of those risks is insider threat, which I guess we saw with Conti and TrickBot and leaked communications.
Yeah.
So that's their theory there, that the risk-reward payoff has changed. So that'd be good news because it makes it harder for those operators to really have a lot of affiliates that only do part of the job.
By the way, you mentioned the last 6 months since Colonial, and I know time flies, but just to freak you out, the Colonial pipeline ransomware attack was actually in May last year, so it's been more than a year since it happened.
As soon as I said it, is it only 6 months? No.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, there's also some bad news here as well, which is kind of unavoidable.
Yeah, so the European Cybersecurity Agency, they conducted a big survey, and I really like that you've got organizations like that conducting surveys and trying to pull data out and tell us what's going on. But I actually come to the opposite conclusion, basically, that ransomware has evolved, becoming more efficient and causing more devastating attacks. So that is actually the opposite of Coveware's analysis. Coveware also found, by the way, that fewer people were paying ransoms. So that's another piece of good news. And I kind of dive into why. So the European Union agency sampled cases that it found in reports, open source reporting, security reports, and sort of public disclosures, and also what appeared on ransomware sites. So you've got two totally different data sets.
But none of them are good. Like, none of the data sets that go into this stuff are good. And that's why, you know, various bureaucrats in the United States are kind of trying to push lawmakers to pass laws that would make people report this stuff so they can actually get some meaningful metrics. And, you know, when I introduced this discussion, you know, it's kind of something I was driving at as well, which is that it's very difficult to get an accurate picture of what's happening. I will say, though, that when we started seeing Cyber Command doing a little bit of interference and whatnot in some of these with some of these operators, we did predict that we would see more vertical integration of ransomware crews as the big targets started getting chased a little harder. So I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that the ransomware as a service sort of falling out of fashion lines up with that prediction pretty well, and it is actually good news, because what I think we will see after this phase is the vertically integrated crews, the ones who overstep the boundaries are going to be treated like the ransomware as a service crews were previously, right? So you're going to wind up with more and more specialist vertically integrated ransomware operations instead of very, very big ones. And that's good, because then it's much easier to send signals about what's acceptable and what's not, and what gets you the full Cyber Command treatment, basically, is what I'm getting at. So, you know, even if we did see this change to vertical integration, but still a lot of carnage, I still think it's good news, because you've changed the model in such a way that it's easier to target who you hit with a stick, if that makes sense. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I'd kind of describe it. My interpretation of what you said is that we'll end up with a smaller number of possibly better groups, but they'll be doing less stuff.
Yeah.
So with ransomware,
well, they might even
service,
do more stuff, but maybe less risky stuff, like taking down energy pipelines that supply the entire east coast of the United States.
Yeah. I guess one ransomware incident is not the same as another one.
Yeah.
Right. So if you get more less impactful stuff, that's probably a net win.
And there was also, we saw a new piece of legislation introduced in the United States. I think it's already passed, actually. And it is the most spectacular backronym in US government history.
Yep, the Ransomware Act. What does it stand for? Reporting Attacks from Nations Selected for Oversight and Monitoring Web Attacks and Ransomware from Enemies.
Yeah.
So that's a mouthful. I love the backronym. It requires the FTC to report on cross-border ransomware complaints every 2 years. So I don't think that this is going to move the needle at all, but I love an effective backronym.
Well, the fact that it's not going to do anything is probably why it passed with bipartisan support, right? Because, you know, the fact that a bill passed at all in the United States is a miracle. Now, look, the third and final thing, final major item that we're going to be discussing this week is you've got a really interesting piece here about TikTok. It turns out that the Chinese government actually tried to ask TikTok executives to establish an account on the service that would not appear linked to the Chinese government, that was designed to spew propaganda targeting Western consumers, essentially. And TikTok's executives said no, which is kind of surprising, right? Like, they actually showed some backbone in this instance. But you make the point that the fact that the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, is trying to do this sort of stuff is a pretty bad omen to begin with. Like, they, you know, it's really up to the CCP whether they step up these efforts.
Yeah, so there's another story I talk about where a previous app owned by ByteDance, so these news reports came out in the same week, was promoting Chinese content. And it was what seems like innocuous stuff like panda videos and videos about traveling to China and setting up a business there. So the point of both of them is the Chinese government has intent and they want to use platforms to promote their message. And in fact, the Chinese government has a whole, I'd call it a strategy, I guess, initiated by Xi Jinping himself, which is to tell China's story well. So that's the phrase he uses to describe it. And that was early on in his term. And they've invested hugely in China Global TV, television network. They take foreign journalists and they bring them to China and train them in telling China's story well. And they even use economic power to censor Hollywood movies. So when's the last time you went to a Hollywood movie and there was a Chinese villain? You know, other than the only movie I could think of was Shang-Chi and the Seven Rings. The other movie I thought of was Iron Man, where one of the characters is he's actually called the Mandarin, but he's been whitewashed in that it's played by, who played Gandhi? English character.
Ben Kingsley.
Ben Kingsley, yeah. And that's all a reaction to the economic heft that China's movie audience has. So Hollywood self-censors in reaction to the way that the Chinese media market is controlled by the Communist Party. So this is all part of a grand strategy. So that's what makes me worried. And it sort of moves it from the realm of, well, you know, what's the harm in panda videos to this is just a part of the way that the Communist Party operates. Like, that's standard practice at home and they're trying to export that.
Well, I mean, that reading between the lines in what you've written here, you know, you're sort of suggesting that China asked, TikTok said no, but that's probably not the end of it, if we're going to be realistic.
I think there's an open question about how sure can we be that TikTok continues to say no. To me, the policy questions are, what would we need to know to make sure? How important is it that we stop it? And, like, what do we do? We know that we're interested. The Chinese government is interested, and we know that TikTok's actually tremendously influential as well. So there's all sorts of trends that spin off of TikTok that don't really come from things like YouTube. I think it's actually really worth figuring out the answers to those questions.
Yeah, well, good luck. That's a hard one. Ben Kingsley too, also in sneakers. And if anybody's listening to this hasn't seen the film Sexy Beast, that Ben Kingsley's in that and he's terrific. And what's most amazing about it is the same man who played Gandhi is in this film playing a gangster who's completely terrifying. So I'd highly recommend people check. Have you seen Sexy Beast, Tom?
That's been on my to-watch list for many years,
Mate, God. Well, we know what you've got to do this weekend. It's a cracking film. Now, just before we go, there's one more item from the newsletter, from the short items in the newsletter that I did want to discuss because we didn't have room for it on the, we didn't really think to discuss it on the main Risky Business podcast, which is that the CISA in the United States has signed a deal with its Ukrainian counterpart to cooperate on cybersecurity. Like, what's the gist of this agreement? Is it real or is it something symbolic? Or I'm just curious if you can tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, so that was my first question as well. Like, what does it mean in the context of the war? I would have thought that anything that the US could provide to Ukraine was being provided.
Yeah,
whether it's announced or not. So when you look at it, it's a memorandum of cooperation, sharing best practices on incident response, critical infrastructure, security, technical exchanges, and training and joint exercises.
So it's more around skills uplift than, you know, indicators of compromise. Yeah.
And they all struck me as what I'd call strategic things you want to get done, but you're not necessarily focusing on in the context of a hot war. Like, you're doing what you need to do. So I think there is some meaning in this, in that it's committing both parties to set aside some time to do these kind of long-term important things that would be very easy to forget when you're, you know, putting out daily fires.
Yes, they're training their soldiers for the cyber war, Tom. They're cyber soldiers for the cyber war. Let's just try to, you know, squeeze a few cybers in at the end. My friend, thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation with me. We will not be doing this the next couple of weeks because I'm going to be away and everybody else is going to be in Vegas anyway. But look, thanks so much for your excellent work on this newsletter, and thanks for having a chat with me, and I'll be doing this again with you in a few weeks.
Thanks, Matt.